This morning I thought it might be useful to talk about the idea of devotion in terms of practice and what that in one sense can mean. When I was in college age, by the time I had reached college age, for myself I had kind of tasted the harshness with which the world can treat beings, and found myself wanting to do things differently than I had encountered in the world. I wanted to do things differently than my parents did them. Not that I have a problem with my parents per se, but as a young man, I wanted to do things differently than my parents did things. I wanted to do things differently than the culture around me did things. I've tasted a little bit of the distractions of pleasure, and I found them to not really address the issue of how harsh the world can be. At best, it can just seemingly distract us from that harshness. And so part of my wish in life became a strong wish to do things, to find a different way of being in the world and to do things differently to accord with that different way of being. That different way of being in the world I conceived of as living from a true place, living from truth. And I was willing at the time to really go against the stream of what was happening around me. I was willing to do things differently than my friends and peers, and willing to be perceived as being a little bit weird. Because I was, in a way, tired of that harsh quality of life. And so that is, on one level, what brought me to practice, and I saw practice, the practice that we do, as a way, as a vehicle for me to respond to my personal aspiration, my personal wish, to find this different way of being, to do things differently. And it nicely articulated the kind of core of the thing, which was to follow the path of awakening to the truth, follow the path in a sense of meeting the Buddha, meeting Buddha nature, finding it in myself, meeting it in other people. And again, as a young person, I made the determination in myself to do this thing, to not be diverted. I was very interested in mountaineering when I was a teenager, and really loved the outdoors. And at some point in my contemplation of all this, I thought to myself, I must have climbed mountains in former existences. And for this lifetime, I'm going to set that aside. I'm going to set aside pursuit of that type of pleasure, and really focus on this thing about being, about awakening and following the path of being true, of following the path of truth. And so, as I say, I've encountered practice, and the Buddha Dharma for me gave me guidance in a way to realize that wish that arose in me. So there was this part of me that had this wish, and the Buddha Dharma met the need to follow that and to understand it and to give me a means of doing that. And so I made my commitment to it, and met in a sense then River Master Jiyu, who seemed to be a live person who was doing what I what I wanted to do. She was living that thing that I wanted to live. So in the so in my life since then, I have made it a point of being devoted to this practice and devoted to the tradition and really devoted to my own wish to awaken to what was true, to live from truth. Devoted in the sense of being willing to just keep going and to keep putting myself back into the place of practice. I have not always been successful in doing things differently than I thought I should. I've not always been successful in doing things from truth. And when I look back on those points when I've not been successful, it's with grief and regret. Although at the same time, I've learned a lot from that. I'm not going to claim to be perfect at it or anything like that. When I was thinking about this issue of devotion, there's a story that comes to mind about one of the Buddha's disciples named Moggallana. And I think it's quite interesting and quite useful to reflect on. And so I thought I would read it. It's just a short couple of pages in a book called The Great Disciples of the Buddha. The last days of Moggallana. So this is the end of Moggallana's life. Now Moggallana was one of the two chief disciples of the Buddha. He and Shariputra were the Buddha's main assistants throughout his lifetime of teaching. They really helped him a lot. They went around and trained and ordained new disciples. They articulated the teaching for him. They helped, just basically helped out in many ways. They were a support and an assistant to the Buddha after they had sort of completed their own training. So, and interestingly enough, Shariputra and Moggallana both died before the Buddha died, and so it was just an interesting aspect of their lives. So the last days of Moggallana. Half a year before the Buddha's parinirvana, on the full moon day of the month of Kartika, which is October, November, death separated the two chief disciples for the last time. It was on this day that Shariputra passed away in his birth chamber in his parental home, surrounded by his many pupils, but far away from Moggallana. Even though during life the two had been almost inseparable, their deaths, like their attainment of arahantship, occurred at different places. Soon after the passing away of Shariputra, Moggallana had a bizarre encounter with Mara, the evil one, the tempter and lord of death, which may well have been a premonition of his own imminent demise. One night, while the elder was walking back and forth for exercise, Mara slipped into his body and entered his bowels. Moggallana sat down and attended to his abdomen, which suddenly felt as heavy as a bag of beans. He then discovered the evil one lodged within his own belly. Calmly, he told Mara to get out. Mara was astonished that he had been detected so soon, and in his delusion thought that even the Buddha would not have recognized him so quickly. But Moggallana read his thoughts and again ordered him to depart. Mara now escaped through Moggallana's mouth and stood at the door of the hut. Moggallana told him that he knew him, not only on that day, but had also known him in the past, for their karmic connection was old and deep. Now, Mara, in a sense, we can understand to be the self, our own propensity for error, our own propensity for making mistakes, and that habitual pattern of making mistakes. And so one of the ways you can understand Mara is, and this experience that we're describing here, is that Mogalan is doing his meditation, basically, and he notices self arising and saying, "Oh, I recognize you, self. Depart." And it's useful to understand that even at the end of his life, Mogalana, one of the chief disciples of the Buddha, had this experience of the self arising. And so, again, we can kind of look at that and think, oh, what are my expectations about the self? Even to the very end, even as deeply as enlightened as someone like Mogalana, self arises. So that gives us some insight into our own lives. The following is the gist of what he said. The first of the five Buddhas appearing in our fortunate eon was Kakusanda, whose chief disciples were the arahants Vidura and Sanjiva. At that time, Mogalana was Mara, by name Maradusi. For Mara too, like Mahabrahma and Shakya, is not a permanent being, but a cosmic post or office, chief of demons, lord of the lower world, which is filled by different individuals migrating through the round of existence. At that time, Maradusi had a sister named Kali, whose son was to become the Mara of our age. Hence, Mogalana's new nephew then was now standing in front of him in his hut as the present Mara. When, in that past age, Mogalana was Mara, he had taken possession of a boy and made him throw a potsherd at the head of the Buddha Kakusanda's chief disciple, the arahant Vidura. The wound was a severe one, which caused blood to flow. When the Buddha Kakusanda turned around and saw this, he said, "Indeed, Mara knows no moderation here, for even in diabolical actions, there might be moderation." And under the perfect one's glance, Mara Dusi's body dissolved and reappeared in the deepest hell. Just a moment earlier, he had been overlord of all the hellish worlds, and now himself was one of hell's victims. For many thousands of years, Mogalana had to suffer in hell as the karmic result of attacking an arahant. He was condemned to spend 10,000 years alone in the great hell, having a human body and the head of a fish, just like the beings in Peter Bruegel's pictures of hell. Whenever two lances of his torturers crossed in the heart, he would know that 1,000 years of his torment had passed. This encounter with Mara once more brought to Mogalana's mind the terrors of samsara, from which he was now forever free. Soon afterwards, Mogalana felt that the time of his existence was running out. Being an arahant, he saw no reason to extend his lifespan to the end of the eon by an act of will, and he calmly allowed impermanence to take its lawful course. Mogalana's death. Surrounded by many of his monks, the Buddha passed away peacefully during a meditative absorption, which he entered with perfect mastery. Shariputra's death in his parental home, likewise with fellow monks in attendance, was similarly serene. Ananda died at the age of 120. As he did not wish to burden anyone by his funeral, he entered meditative concentration on the fire element so that his body vanished in a blaze. Considering the serene death of the master and these two disciples, one would have expected that Mahamogalana too would have undergone the final dissolution of the body under peaceful circumstances. But Mogalana's end was very different, though the gruesome nature of his death did not shake his firm and serene mind. Mogalana passed away a fortnight after his friend Shariputra on the new moon day of the month of Kartika, October, November. In the autumn, the great decease of the Buddha took place on the full moon night of the month of Vaisakha, May, half a year after the death of his two chief disciples. The Buddha was in his 80th year when he passed away, while both Shariputra and Mahamogalana died at the age of 84. The circumstances of Mogalana's death are related in two sources, the Dhammapada commentary and the Jataka commentary. Although these two sources share a common core, they differ in details, which no doubt stem from embellishments in the course of oral transmission. The account here will be based on the Dhammapada commentary, with the differences in the Jataka commentary noted parenthetically. So this book is a compilation of of information from sources in the Pali Canon. Because the Buddha was so skillful as a teacher, leading countless people to the gates of deliverance, the populace of Magadha, for the most part, had transferred its allegiances from the various rival ascetic orders to the Enlightened One and his Sangha. A group of naked ascetics, resentful over this loss of prestige, pinned the prime responsibility for their hard times on the venerable Maha Moggallana. They believed that Moggallana had won over their own adherence to the Buddhist Dharma with his reports of his celestial travels, in which he related how he had seen the virtuous devotees of the Buddha enjoying rebirth in heaven and the followers of other sects lacking moral conduct, suffering in miserable subhuman states of existence. These ascetics were so enraged about their loss of popularity that they wanted to eliminate Moggallana. Without accepting responsibility for their own misfortune, they projected the blame externally and concentrated their envy and hate on the great disciple. While the ascetics were hesitant to kill Moggallana by their own hand, they had no scruples about employing others to carry out their nefarious deed. Having procured 1,000 gold coins from their followers, they approached a band of brigands and offered them the money in exchange for the great disciple's life. At that time, Moggallana was living alone in a forest hut at the Black Rock on the slope of Mount Isigili, outside of Rajagriha. After his encounter with Mara, he knew that the end of his days was near. Having enjoyed the bliss of liberation, he now felt the body to be obstruction and burden and had no desire to put his psychic faculties to keep it, to use his psychic faculties to keep it alive for the rest of the eon. Yet, when he saw the brigands approach, he knew they were coming to kill him, and he used his supernormal powers to slip through the keyhole. The gangsters arrived at an empty hut, and though they searched everywhere, they could not find him. They returned the following day too, but this time the elders soared up into the air and escaped through the roof. The next month, too, the bandits came, but again they could not catch the elder. In the Jataka versions, the bandits return on 6 consecutive days and catch him only on the 7th day. Moggallana's motivation in escaping was not fear of death. The reason he used his psychic powers to elude the gangsters was not to protect his body, but to spare the would-be assassins the frightful karmic consequence of such a murderous deed, necessarily leading to rebirth in the hells, as he described his own experience. He wanted to spare them such a fate by giving them time to reconsider and abstain from their crime. But their greed for the promised money was so great that they persisted and returned again the following month, or on the 7th day in the Jataka account. This time their persistence was rewarded, for at that moment Moggallana suddenly lost his psychic mastery over the body. The reason for this sudden change in faith lay in a terrible deed he had committed in the distant past. Many eons ago, in a previous birth, Moggallana had brought about the death of his parents. That heinous crime had brought him to a rebirth in hell for countless years, but it had not yet fully matured. A residue remained, and now, when he was in mortal danger, that residue suddenly ripened and confronted him with its fruit. Moggallana realized that he had no choice but to submit to destiny. The brigands entered, knocked him down, and pounded his bones until they were as small as grains of rice. Then, thinking he was dead, they threw his body behind a clump of bushes and fled, keen on collecting their reward. But Moggallana's physical and mental strength was formidable, and he had not yet capitulated to death. He regained consciousness, and, by the power of meditation, he soared through the air and came into the presence of the Master. There, he announced that he would attain final nirvana. The Buddha asked him to give a final sermon to the community of monks, which he did, with an additional display of wonders and marvels. Then he paid homage to the Buddha, returned to the Black Rock, and passed into the nirvana element without residue. The Jataka account, more realistically, omits the final sermon and has Moggallana expire right at the Buddha's feet. In this last turbulent phase of his life, the karma of the past that had ripened so suddenly could affect only his body, but could not shake his mind. For he no longer identified himself with his empirical personality. For him, the five aggregates that others identified as Moggallana were as foreign as an inanimate body. And then there's a verse. They penetrate the subtle truth as the tip of a hair with an arrow. Who see the five aggregates as alien and do not regard them as self? Those who see conditioned things as alien and not as self have pierced right through the subtle truth as the tip of a hair with an arrow. This last episode of Moggallana's life, however, did show that the law of moral causality has even greater potency than the supernormal feats of a master of psychic power. Only a Buddha can control the karmic consequences acting upon his body to such an extent that nothing might cause his premature death. Speaking about his chief disciples shortly after their deaths, the Buddha declared, "Those who in the past have been holy ones, fully enlightened ones, those blessed ones too, had such excellent pairs of disciples as I had in Shariputra and Moggallana. Those who in the future will be holy ones, fully enlightened ones, those blessed ones too will have such excellent pairs of disciples as I had in Shariputra and Moggallana. Marvelous it is, wonderful it is, bhikkhus, concerning those disciples that they will act in accordance with the Master's teaching, will act in accordance with his advice, that they will be dear to the four assemblies, will be loved, respected, and honored by them." Shariputra and Moggallana were such wonderful disciples, the Buddha said, that the assembly of monks appeared empty to him after their death. It was marvelous that such an excellent pair of disciples existed, but it was marvelous, too, that in spite of their excellence, when the two had passed away, there was no grief, no lamentation on the part of the Master. Therefore, the Buddha continued, inspired by the greatness of the two chief disciples. Therefore, the Buddha continued, inspired by the greatness of the two chief disciples. Let dedicated followers of the Dharma strive to be their own island of refuge, with the Dharma as their island of refuge, not looking for any other refuge. Let them rely entirely on the powerful help of the four foundations of mindfulness. Those who, with keen desire, thus train themselves along the Noble Eightfold Path, will certainly pass beyond all the realms of darkness, which abound in samsara. So the Master assures us. So I think the thing I wanted to draw attention to is that quality of determination and devotion to practice, to liberation of mind, that Moggallana exhibits. In our life, and since I've started practicing, I've discovered that, you know, life is kind of difficult. There are just difficult things that arise, both externally and internally. As I said before, I failed in my aspiration on a number of occasions to do what is best, to do what is good. And I have received the consequences of those failures, those mistakes. And that has not been pleasant. I sometimes think of my life as being sort of like that crawl of Moggallana. I don't imagine him flying to the Buddha. In one story I read, he actually crawls on the ground to the Buddha, and, you know, he's beaten up really badly, his bones the size of pieces of rice, and he crawls on the ground so that he can die in the presence of the Buddha. And in a sense, I kind of think of my own kind of spiritual life as that, as having that quality. Like, I'm on my way to meet the Buddha. I'm on my way to kind of understand what the Buddha taught, what he pointed out, what he showed existed. And sometimes I just have to kind of crawl along on the ground. And it's difficult. It's painful. But still, I have found that there is something which is sustaining in there. I think I was feeling a little discouraged this morning in meditation, and I thought, you know, I'm just not going to stop. I'm just not going, I just am not going to stop. I don't care. Whatever it is, I'm just going to continue to go forward. And I receive the consequences of my former actions. Whether you believe in past lives or not, I don't know. But for myself, I receive the consequences of my former actions. I'm in this world, however it comes about, whatever it's about, I'm in this world which is difficult, and sometimes there are difficult things that happen to people. And still I see my determination, my aspiration, which I developed as a young person, to live from the truth, to find the truth, is still there, is still alive. And it's still, in some sense, bearing fruit for me. It's still, in some sense, a refuge for me, that aspiration. Because, yes, lo and behold, by putting my effort into this practice, my life has improved. My mind has improved. I am happier now than when I started. I'm not always happy, you know. I can have difficulty, like Moggallana. There are difficulties that arise from who knows where. Still, there is unshakable liberation of mind. So there's a quality of practice for me which I want to encourage us to kind of consider cultivating, which is the devotion to going forward even though it is difficult. This devotion really comes from love in a way. It comes from our own love for our life, but also love for and appreciation for what we have been given in terms of practice. Here we have this kind of nice thing laid out for us, this system of practice laid out for us. What an amazing thing, what a really kind of amazing thing. Considering how, you know, I look at myself, look at myself and I think, God, you're really stupid sometimes, you know. I've got kind of blind ignorance in there. What a great blessing to have encountered the Buddha Dharma, which kind of lays it all kind of out nicely for me. I don't always kind of see it or understand it or anything like that, but just by putting myself in this realm, I can kind of rely on that and go forward. And that helps me in my own personal aspiration. And then the other blessing of the Buddha Dharma is, of the Sangha, of the practice of the system, is that we occasionally meet people who are going along with us, who have the same aspiration. Someone like Reverend Master Jiyu, who we see, oh, they are doing what I want to do. When we meet somebody like that, regardless of what kind of tradition or practice they're doing, when we meet someone like that, we should really be careful to preserve that relationship. There have been times, you know, in my practice, there was this kind of experience where I'm reading along and I realize, I'm reading something the Buddha wrote, and I realize the Buddha is there. He's talking to me. He's telling me something. He's responding to my mind. In that sense, I have met the Buddha. It wasn't an easy thing to hear what he had to say about my mind. Sometimes those teachers will be telling us something quite difficult to hear. But there was a quality of that experience where I recognized the truth of it. The Buddha is there. He is talking to me. He's talking to what's going on in my mind. And what he's saying is true. It's not easy to hear, but it's true. And if I'm going to live by truth, which I've determined to do, which I have said, this is what I'm going to do in my life. Sorry. Then I better listen when he speaks. And so our devotion, in one sense, is devotion to a thing, an ism, a practice. But really, it is that devotion, that life of our own kind of aspiration. That's what our devotion is to. That's what our devotion is to. And our adoration, our devotion is to the people who embody that thing outside of ourselves and the teachings that embody that thing outside of ourselves. And so we can go through and express our gratitude in that way. We can go forward and express our gratitude in that way that Mogalana did, you know. Okay, I'm on my way. It's difficult, but I'm going. I'm not going to be stopped. So that's what I have to say today. Any thoughts or comments?
So we can all do that. Every master talks about the mind that seeks the way and aspiration to cultivating that. And it's something that will stand you in good stead. And in my experience, it's the only thing that will help you survive what you'll need to do. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily true for everybody, but it certainly is for me. So we strongly recommend it. And for me, for me personally, I think the thing that I remind myself most often about that embodies that very aspiration is willingness. My willingness to continue however I feel. Whatever is coming up, my willingness to just experience those things that I'm experiencing and bow to that and not let those things that I'm experiencing that I may not like get in the way of my determination to train with the deep faith that whatever it is that I'm experiencing that I may not like or that I may be very, very attached to will get taken care of in the process. And it's not a blind faith, because it's something I have discovered for myself that it actually does happen when we train. So we hold out this encouragement that you do it for yourself. Find it for yourself and awaken that aspiration and don't let go. And when you let go, okay, fine, grab on again. Pick yourself up and it's okay. And we truly wish everybody well.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you.